Welcome to the debate. So imagine, if you will, a colossal cargo ship navigating through this really treacherous, uncharted storm.
Like a massive supertanker, right?
Yeah, exactly. A massive supertanker. And the lookout in the crow's nest can clearly see a jagged reef dead ahead, but they have no radio to the bridge.
Oh, wow. Not ideal.
Right. Not ideal at all. And then the engineer down below decks, they control the speed of the vessel, but they literally cannot see out of a window.
Right.
And the person holding the wheel, they have the radio, but they speak a completely different language that the engineer just doesn't understand.
So it's basically a total communication breakdown.
A total breakdown. And if we try to solve that by, you know, firing everyone and putting just one single person in charge of everything, well, that one individual physically cannot stand in the crow's nest, steer the wheel, and tend the engine all at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, the ship is just too massive.
Exactly. The tasks are way too specialized. And that ship is essentially modern global governance in a nutshell.
It really is.
So today we're diving into Dr. Bechara's Hali 2026 paper. It's called Institutions of Reflexive Transformation. And it asks a pretty terrifying question, honestly.
Yeah, it does.
It asks, you know, when the world is quite literally on fire, when we're facing these massive cross-system civilizational injuries, do we actually need bounded hierarchy and centralized power to put the fire out?
Or does that kind of centralization just, you know, create a brand new kind of tyranny?
Right. And I'll be arguing today that separating our institutions by function, so keeping the people who assess the facts strictly separated from the people who actually authorize the action, is really the only sustainable way to solve these global crises without just slipping into outright authoritarianism.
Right. And I will be arguing that while separating powers sounds, you know, very elegant in an academic setting, highly distributed networks inherently suffer from a fatal lack of leverage.
Okay.
When it comes down to addressing severe civilizational injuries, where delay literally means irreversible collapse, we actually require robust, bounded hierarchy. We need that rather than this endlessly fragmented coordination.
So you think decentralization is just too slow?
Basically, yeah. We simply cannot afford the luxury of a deeply decentralized system when the house is burning down.
Well, let's lay out why that decentralization, or, you know, differentiation, is so crucial. Because at the heart of Seiley's framework is what he calls the coordination-domination dilemma.
Right. The core tension.
Yeah. If you're familiar with this topic, you likely recognize that our biggest civilizational injuries, so climate change, systemic health crises, ecological collapse, they do not respect neat institutional boundaries.
No, they definitely don't.
The effects travel across jurisdictions, across economies, ecosystems. But if we just simply centralize the coordination to handle these sprawling issues.
Like building a global command center or something.
Exactly. If we build a global command center, we risk massive epistemic and political overreach.
Sure.
Because a central office that standardizes all the data can suddenly just dictate what is administratively real and what gets completely ignored.
Yeah, the sovereign problem.
Right. So to avoid this, Sahali introduces a central institutional grammar, which is integrate consequences, differentiate authority.
Right. And in practice, he terms that a function authority legitimacy architecture.
Yes, exactly. And what that means is that competence in one area absolutely does not confer legitimate authority in another.
Okay, break that down for us.
So if you are, say, a brilliant climate scientist, your expertise warrants assessing evidence, right? But it does not give you the legitimate authority to choose distributive economic ends for a society.
Like deciding which factories have to close down and which ones get to stay open.
Precisely. You don't get to make that call just because you know the science. And conversely, if you are a democratically elected politician, your electoral mandate warrants authorizing collective action.
Right, you get to make the laws.
But it categorically does not warrant manufacturing or suppressing scientific evidence to fit your political goals. We absolutely have to separate the assessment of reality from the authorization of action.
Look, I acknowledge the danger of domination, of course. I mean, no one wants an unchecked sovereign just dictating both the facts and the laws.
Right.
But the far more common and frankly present danger in global governance right now is not total domination.
What is it then?
It is exactly what Saheli describes as polycentric fragmentation and institutional incoherence. I mean, we currently have these highly differentiated systems that just routinely suffer from what he calls jurisdictional voids.
Well, explain what that void actually looks like on the ground for someone dealing with it.
So a jurisdictional void is basically the state where a civilizational injury is widely acknowledged, right?
Okay.
Like, everyone agrees the river is dying. Everyone agrees the carbon emissions are way too high. But the actual responsibility to fix it is owned nowhere.
Right. Everyone's passing the buck?
Exactly. We have these endless nodes of governance. We've got local councils, state regulators, federal agencies, international bodies, and they are all expertly pointing the finger at someone else to move first.
Yeah, I mean, coordination is hard.
It is. And even Saley concedes that hierarchy belongs where tasks are tightly coupled, right? Where delay is catastrophic or where uniform rights floors are required.
He does say that, yes.
Well, my position is that civilizational healing inherently fits these exact criteria. The crises we face right now are tightly coupled. Delay is quite literally catastrophic.
Obviously.
And we need uniform global rights. So relying on this intricate, you know, ecology of semi-autonomous institutions just adjusting to one another, it's a theoretical luxury we simply can't afford when time is essentially out.
Okay, but let's look at how that ecology actually functions in practice when it's designed correctly, specifically regarding the boundary authority principle.
Okay, let's look at it.
Because the separation of powers isn't just some bureaucratic nicety designed to slow things down. It is the core mechanism that protects the integrity of our knowledge.
Sure, in theory.
No, in reality. Look at the configuration between the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCC.
Right.
This is a prime example of what academics call managed permeability. It's basically a one-way mirror.
A one-way mirror. Okay.
Yeah. The scientists can clearly see the political realities and the policy questions, but the politicians cannot reach through the glass to alter the data.
On paper, yes, that is how it works.
And in reality, because by keeping scientific assessment in the IPCC strictly separated from political authorization in the UNFCC, the evidence remains credible.
I mean, they still have government involvement.
They do, yes. The scientists assess the published knowledge, handle the transparent review, state the uncertainties. Governments do participate in scoping and line-by-line approval of the summaries.
Which is highly political.
But they do it under highly traceable, transparent rules. Because of this strict boundary restraint, the scientific consensus remains untainted by direct state interests or, you know, backroom political horse trading, even as it actively shapes the global political agenda.
Okay, I see the appeal of that experimentalist architecture. It sounds great, but let's look at the actual leverage it provides, or more accurately, the leverage it totally lacks.
Okay.
You brought up the environmental context. So let's look at the European Union Water Framework Directive, the WFD.
Sure, a massive piece of legislation.
Right. On paper, it is a beautiful, deeply sophisticated system. It has dense monitoring, common guidance across member states, river basin planning, technical working groups.
It's very thorough.
It is exactly the kind of differentiated, reflexive ecology you are advocating for. And yet, when the official reporting came out in 2025, do you know what the results were?
I know they weren't perfect.
Only about 39.5% of reported surface water bodies achieved good ecological status. Nearly two decades of work, and over 60% of the rivers are still failing.
But that's an implementation issue, not a flaw in the design itself.
Hold on, I have to stop you there, because the design is the implementation issue.
How so?
Why did it fail? It failed because when feedback lacks budgetary, sectoral, or enforcement consequences, when the water monitors can't legally force the agricultural ministry to change fertilizer policies, strict boundary differentiation simply creates a siloed lack of leverage.
It creates boundaries, yes.
The WFD basically proves that you can have all the scientific assessment and local participation in the world. You can have a perfect one-way mirror.
Right.
But if the assessor has no coercive authority over the polluter, you just get really, really well documented ecological failure. It doesn't matter if you have perfect data showing the system is broken if you don't have the teeth to actually fix it.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on this. Because if you're listening to this, you might be thinking, well, why not just give the assessor the power to fix the problem? If the monitor sees pollution, just give them the power to shut down the farm.
Exactly. Give them the authority.
But here is the terrifying reality of doing that. Think of this through the analogy of a diagnostic doctor versus a surgeon.
Okay.
The doctor is the IPCC, or the Environmental Monitoring Agency. Their job is to run the blood tests, look at the MRI, and objectively declare the presence of a tumor.
Right. Assess the facts.
Yes. The surgeon, which represents the political apparatus, is the one authorized to actually cut into the patient, allocate the resources, and manage the, you know, the life or death risk of the operation.
Sure.
If the diagnostic doctor suddenly has the coercive authority to physically drag you out of your house and strap you to the operating table against your will, we completely lose objective diagnosis to perverse incentives.
Well,
we get technocratic tyranny. The diagnostician absolutely must remain just a diagnostician.
But if the hospital administrator refuses to unlock the operating room, it doesn't matter how accurate the MRI is.
Okay.
The patient still suffers. That is exactly the EU water directive. The monitors have the MRI. They clearly see the pollution. But the agricultural ministries and the administrators, in this analogy, just refuse to act.
Which is a failure of political authorization and interoperability. It means the surgeon and the administrator are failing.
Right.
But that is not a valid reason to fuse the doctor, the surgeon, and the administrator into a single terrifying entity. If the agricultural ministries are refusing to act, the solution is building stronger legal pathways that force political accountability, not destroying the separation of powers entirely.
But those legal pathways are exactly what a distributed network struggles to build when confronting massive scale.
I don't think that's inherently true.
It is. And this naturally brings us to the fatal flaw in relying on distributed networks, the issue of causal scale.
Okay, let's get into scale.
How can a polycentric, highly localized system ever properly align with the scale of a global crisis?
By escalating the issue, Sahali talks about this.
But do they ever truly escalate effectively? Let me bring in the Great Barrier Reef governance case.
Oh, that's a classic example.
Right. Here you have a highly sophisticated, polycentric ecology. It includes the Commonwealth and Queensland governments, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, traditional owners, scientific bodies, local governments, NGOs.
It's a very dense network.
It's incredibly dense. It's highly participatory. It has excellent localized feedback loops. And yet, if you look at the 2024 Outlook report for the reef, it shows it is fundamentally overwhelmed by global climate forcing.
Yes, the bleaching events are tragic.
The warming oceans, the supercyclones, the acidification, these are driven by global emissions. The causal scale of the problem absolutely dwarfs the institutional scale of the reef's governance.
Well, local actors can't solve global warming.
Exactly. The local actors can manage tourism and fishing perfectly, but they cannot stop the ocean from boiling. This proves that distributed, localized systems, no matter how exquisitely designed they are simply crushed by centralized global drivers.
It's a mismatch. Yes.
The only way to stop a centralized driver is with centralized hierarchical leverage.
Okay, I completely agree that the reef is a tragedy of causal mismatch. The local authority absolutely cannot fix a global injury.
Right.
But that doesn't defeat the polycentric model. It actually validates Saley's specific requirement within it.
How does Failing validate the model?
Because his framework explicitly demands escalation to higher levels when externalities or rights violations or the sheer scale of the causal system exceed local capacity.
Okay, but
subsidiarity doesn't mean just leaving global problems to local councils to drown in. When a problem escapes a boundary, you escalate it. And we have a magnificent proof of concept for this, the Montreal Protocol.
Ah, the treaty to protect the ozone layer.
Exactly. It dealt with ozone-depleting substances by utilizing differentiated responsibilities and escalating the financial solution to a global scale.
Right.
It established the Multilateral Fund, which actually financed the incremental costs for developing nations so they could transition away from harmful chemicals.
Sure.
It wasn't a centralized world government. It was a global mechanism that connected higher-level resourcing
with local implementation. It scaled up the capacity without centralizing the political power into one sovereign.
You claim Montreal proves we can scale up political responses to global drivers without creating a global sovereign. But Montreal worked precisely because it had centralized hierarchical teeth.
It had compliance mechanisms.
It used binding treaty controls and trade provisions to force compliance. It wasn't just some loose ecology of actors cheerfully sharing information and respecting boundaries. It was a mechanism of coercion.
I wouldn't call it coercion.
If a state didn't comply, they faced devastating trade restrictions. That is hierarchy.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because I think you're conflating systemic interoperability with monocentric domination.
How so?
Escalating a problem up the chain of governance, like establishing global funding mechanisms or trade rules in Montreal, is not the same as creating a global monarch.
It's a form of centralized power.
But Montreal still required national legislatures to pass domestic laws. It required local agencies to enforce them. We can absolutely scale funding and establish binding rights floors at a global level while still retaining a polycentric structure for the actual implementation and review.
If the nodes are actually independent.
Right. We don't need a single global executive branch dictating every facet of human life. We just need the global nodes to have interoperable legal and budgetary pathways that connect down to local capacity.
But again, that entirely assumes the nodes are actually independent. And this is where I think Saley's framework and your defense of it just hits a massive brick wall in the 21st century.
Okay, where does it hit a wall?
I want to move from historical environmental treaties to the modern technological frontier. Because if we look at artificial intelligence, it exposes why true polycentricity is an illusion today. We need to talk about infrastructural monocentricity.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about it. It's a huge issue.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. You talk about distributing authority across different agencies, keeping the assessor separate from the implementer, ensuring they all act as independent checks and balances, right?
Right, the whole function authority separation.
Okay, so imagine we have five completely independent government ministries. One handles health, one handles agriculture, one justice, one defense, and one education.
Sure.
In your framework, they are this beautiful polycentric ecology. But what happens when all five of those ministries rely on the exact same cloud provider?
Right.
The exact same commercial data broker and the exact same proprietary AI foundation model to process their information and make their decisions?
Well, they become reliant on a single point of failure. I don't disagree with that.
They become subjects to a hidden technological sovereign. If they are all using the exact same black box algorithm, then we have massive, unchallengeable structural centralization.
The infrastructure is centralized, yes.
The vendor determines the update cycles, the permissible uses, the classifications embedded in the algorithm, and the cost of exit. Their formal political plurality, you know, the fact that they have different ministers and different mandates, is entirely masking the reality that the infrastructure of knowledge itself is monocentric.
Right.
You simply cannot have a polycentric constitutional ecology when the underlying cognitive infrastructure is owned by a single monopoly.
That is a profound concern. And I absolutely acknowledge the severe danger of infrastructural lock-in.
It's happening right now.
It is. The synchronization of error across independent agencies, this idea that the Health Department and the Justice Department make the exact same biased error because they bought the exact same algorithm, it's a terrifying prospect.
Extremely.
In fact, this is precisely why the UN General Assembly Resolution 79325 regarding AI governance was established.
Right.
It created an independent international scientific panel on AI to assess these very risks, completely separate from the commercial providers. But honestly, your diagnosis here actually proves my point.
Wait, how does an AI monopoly prove the need for decentralized governance?
Because the solution to a hidden tech monopoly is not to just throw up our hands and create a visible political monopoly to match it.
Well, if we centralize the government to fight a centralized corporation, we just replace a corporate sovereign with a state sovereign, both of which are highly prone to dominating the public.
So what's the alternative?
The solution is what Saley calls constitutional reflexivity.
And how does constitutional reflexivity practically dismantle a multi-trillion dollar monopoly on compute and data? Because, I mean, a UN scientific panel issuing a warning report doesn't change the structural power dynamic at all.
It's not just about issuing reports. It's about how a decentralized system uses its collective leverage.
But how does that leverage actually work against a monopoly?
By writing interoperability requirements directly into the foundational procurement contracts of all five of those ministries simultaneously.
Okay.
The decentralized network creates a unified market barrier. You make the dependencies visible and legally contestable. We don't just ask nicely, we mandate modularity.
Mandating modularity still requires power.
Right, but we enforce data portability so agencies aren't locked into a single ecosystem. We demand independent public interest evaluation capacity built into the contracts so the ministries aren't just taking the vendor's word for what the model is actually doing.
Sure, but
we don't centralize the government. We decentralize the infrastructure. We ensure that the system remains corrigible, that when a persistent relational failure is identified, there's a legal mechanism to rewrite the rules of interaction.
But rewriting the rules inherently requires power. It requires leverage.
It requires legal authority, yes.
If the cloud provider or the AI vendor holds all the structural power, if they can simply walk away and cripple the government's operational capacity, then enforcing those procurement contracts becomes a massive game of chicken that the decentralized ministries will almost certainly lose.
I think that's unnecessarily fatalistic.
No. It goes right back to my point about the hospital administrator refusing to open the operating room. Epistemic reflexivity, just knowing you are locked into a monopoly, is completely useless without transformational capacity.
You need both.
Exactly. But if the institutions coordinating a response to civilizational injuries, whether that's ecological collapse on the Great Barrier Reef or AI lock-in across our governments, if they don't have the bounded hierarchical authority to enforce their mandates against entrenched incumbents, then constitutional reflexivity just becomes a bureaucratic ritual.
A ritual?
Yes! We will perfectly document our own demise.
Well, I think we are really arriving at the core tension of this entire subject.
Definitely.
If I can summarize my position in light of our discussion today, preserving distinct functional authorities, so keeping the doctor and the surgeon separate and ensuring our systems remain open to continuous constitutional redesign, is really the only sustainable way to operate.
Right.
Because if we simply reach for the hammer of centralized hierarchy every single time we face a crisis, we inevitably slip into either technocratic or political tyranny. We must integrate cross-system knowledge by connecting consequences to authorized actors, but we absolutely cannot afford to surrender the distinct standards of validity that make our science, our laws, and our democratic choices legitimate in the first place.
And to summarize my stance, while the theory of checks, balances, and distinct functional authorities is lovely in an academic symposium, the lived reality of entrenched civilizational injuries demands something more.
Something stronger.
Much stronger. To overcome entrenched power, whether it's fossil fuel incumbents boiling the oceans or monopolistic AI providers capturing our civic infrastructure, we need actionable leverage.
Right.
We must not be afraid to utilize bounded hierarchy to match the causal scale of the crises we face. If the driver of the crisis is global and highly concentrated, a fragmented polycentric response will simply be overwhelmed, no matter how many reflexive feedback loops it has.
Well, we might entirely disagree on the ideal architecture to fix this, but there is no denying Sahali's core warning here. Our current institutions have the capacity to monitor our collapse, but severely lack the leverage to stop it.
Yeah, unfortunately true.
The jurisdictional voids you mention are real, and they are fatal.
Absolutely. I mean, we are in total agreement on Sahali's ultimate operational requirement for any system. Institutions must possess the capacity to act, plus the capacity to correct.
Exactly.
One without the other is just a recipe for disaster. Capacity without correction is domination. Correction without capacity is just paralysis.
It really highlights the profound difficulty of the coordination-domination dilemma. There is no simple switch to flip, and, you know, neither of us is pretending there is an easy way out of this.
No, definitely not.
We highly encourage our listeners to dive deeply into the source material. Look closely at the institutions in your own lives, your local councils, your environmental regulators, your digital infrastructure, and ask who holds the authority and what happens when they fail.
Lies on designing better distributed coordination, or if we need to demand more decisive, centralized leverage to pull us back from the brink before it's too late.
Returning to our colossal cargo ship in the storm, we know the Jagged Reef is there.
We see it coming.
We know the engine is running. The question remains, can we build a communication system that allows the lookout, the engineer, and the captain to save the ship without giving any one of them the power to throw the others overboard? Thank you for listening.